Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
25 years after the LA civil unrest, what has changed?
But first,
the roots of the ultra-conservative media movement. With us is Nicole Hemmer. She is Assistant Professor of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Welcome, Nicole Hemmer. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. It's a fantastic book. And even in your preface, I was struck by the similarity of your experience with your father and my experience with my father.
Oh, interesting.
Those political conversations and him being influenced by this sort of very extreme right talk show hosts. Tell us what happened with your dad.
So I was home in the summer of 2004, which was in the middle of a pretty hot presidential election between George W. Bush, who was running for re-election, and John Kerry, the Democrat. And I was in the car one day with my dad, and he turned to me and he said, "My project for this visit is to get you to vote for George W. Bush." And he didn't launch into an argument or into a debate or into any sort of discussion. He reached over and he turned on the radio. We started listening to Rush Limbaugh and then to Sean Hannity. You know, it didn't change my vote, but it did make me very interested in why he thought that listening to those programs would change my politics. And that's what got me so interested in conservative media.
Now, did he ever change his perspective, or did he continue to listen to those same pundits and talk show hosts and stay on the conservative path?
Oh, he did. He stayed conservative the rest of his life. He listened to a lot of conservative media. It was the basis for a lot of our political debates. You know, I think some people have this image of folks who listen to conservative media as just being sponges who absorb it all and then sort of wring it out when they're in political conversations. My dad engaged it, I thought, in a different way from that. He understood when somebody like Rush Limbaugh was being over the top. He would dismiss some of the arguments that he didn't agree with. He would modify other ones when it was sort of what he agreed with and sort of not. So there was a real engagement there. I don't know that that's true for everyone who listens to talk radio, but it was definitely true for him and in my debates with him.
The findings of media effects experiments find that this is generally true. They don't take it automatically. People do pick and choose what agrees with them and what doesn't. But mm-hmm. The framing matters. So let's move into the history that you looked at here, and particularly this connection between the far right, the media enterprises, and the campaigns. When you started to do your history, you found that this traced all the way back into earlier, much earlier times than Rush Limbaugh. How far back did it go?
The birth of conservative media that I look at, it kind of starts in the 1940s, but it really gets underway in the 1950s, especially because folks on the right were very disappointed, in fact, suspicious of the fact that a conservative senator, Robert Taft, didn't win the Republican nomination in 1952. They felt that the Republican convention in 1952 had been rigged and that the nomination had been stolen from this conservative candidate. And part of what is fueling their media enterprises is their sense that they had sort of a right to rule, and it was being denied them by the parties, by the media. And so they went out to start their own media enterprises in order to change the political culture in the United States in order to grab power. Now, they very quickly moved from just doing media to being political organizers. By 1956, folks in conservative media like Clarence Mannion, who was a radio broadcaster, like Bill Buckley, who was the founder of National Review, were engaged in formal electoral politics. Clarence Mannion was the campaign manager for a third-party ticket that ran in 1956 against Eisenhower from a conservative perspective. So that tie with electoral politics was there right from the beginning.
There are three names that you mentioned early on. Clarence Mannion was one of them, but there were also two others, William Rusher and Henry Regnery. Am I saying that correctly?
That's right. Yes, these are the main characters of the book. I wanted to explore sort of the wide world of conservative media, not just broadcasting. So Mannion was a broadcaster. Henry Regnery had a publishing house, so he was publishing conservative books at a time when pretty much no one else was doing it. And Bill Rusher was the publisher of National Review, which was a weekly news magazine that would become fortnightly a little later on. And these were men who had been involved in politics, who were Ivy League graduates, who were well-connected, who had been involved in all sorts of sort of elite institutions, who in the 1940s and 50s start media enterprises, start these media careers that they have, because they believe that you have to control the means of communication. You have to control ideas if you're going to affect real political change. And so I follow these men over the course of the 40s and 50s and 60s as they work to build these institutions and to change American politics.
Now, one of them had been moderately left but moved away. What happened?
Mm-hmm. So Bill Rusher, when he was at Princeton, where he got his undergraduate degree, he had been essentially a moderate Republican. He argued, in fact, in his senior thesis that there should be a more progressive Republican Party, that that was how the Republican Party was going to compete with the New Deal Democrats, who by the time that Rusher was writing this thesis in the 1940s had already had a pretty strong hold on power, both in the Congress and the presidency. And so Rusher was interested not necessarily in conservatism, but in Republican political power. It's not until the late 1940s and the 1950s when he becomes deeply concerned, maybe even obsessed, with communism and the way that communism is potentially influencing U.S. politics, that he becomes a more committed conservative. And when that happens, and when he sees the election of Eisenhower, and when he sees Eisenhower go after the Red Hunter, Joe McCarthy, that's when he says, well, the Republican Party is not a party of ideas. It's involved in the same kind of compromises and the same kind of idea-free politics that the Democratic Party is, and I don't want anything to do with that. I want to wage the battle of ideas. And then he moves from being involved with the Republican Party to being more of an independent and being a conservative activist.
One of the things particularly fascinating in your book had to do with how far back certain ideas have gone. And one of the key ones was the idea that the media, the traditional media, the mainstream media, was liberally biased. How far back does that idea go, and how did it benefit them then?
It goes back to, I would say, again, the 1940s and 1950s. And the reason it goes back to that point and not back further is that in order for you to make the charge that the media are biased, first, there has to be the expectation that media should be unbiased. And that was actually a relatively new development in American history. In the 19th century, America, like many countries in Europe today, had a partisan press where political parties often sponsored newspapers. There wasn't any expectation of objectivity. It's really not until the 1930s and 40s and 50s that you get the expectation of objective journalism in the United States. And you don't just get the expectation, but it's tied to a bigger idea of what America is and what its values are. This idea, particularly after World War II, that the United States had defeated fascism, it had defeated totalitarianism, it was in this battle against communism, and the special genius of the American system was that it was non-ideological, that it was run by experts and people who were not driven by their emotions, but were driven by their intellects. And media were part of that. This idea that journalism should be objective was this idea that it should be professional, it should be expert, and it should be unemotional. And it's in that atmosphere that conservatives begin to accuse journalists of being biased toward liberalism. And as used to as we are of hearing that charge, at the time, it was a shocking thing to say because it didn't just go to the heart of objectivity in journalism, but it went to the heart of the thing that made America different, that it wasn't ideological. And so over the course of the decades, conservatives nurture this idea of liberal bias. They say objectivity isn't actually objectivity. It's just a mask that is draped over this bias to disguise it. And because all media are actually biased toward liberalism, we need a counterbalance to that. We need a conservative media to balance out that liberal media. And so it was the justification for the media enterprises that they had started. And so you see them having a real vested interest in spreading that idea of liberal bias. For the first 10 or 15 years, it's very much just in conservative circles. But by the time Richard Nixon becomes president in 1969, it becomes one of the keystones of his politics, his charge that the media are biased against him and that the media are biased toward liberalism and leftism. And so it gets a real power as it becomes part of the national conversation in the late 1960s.
And you noted in that chapter that not only did they attack the idea of objectivity and intellect, but they replaced it with what you called ideological integrity, this sort of a legitimacy by ideology. Explain that for us.
One of the more complicated ideas that I try to follow through here is what I would say is an epistemological question, a question of how we know things are true or untrue. And for a long time in the United States, the way that we knew that things were true or untrue were these Enlightenment ideas of factuality. If you could verify it in reality, then you could demonstrate that it was true. And so this idea of factuality and neutrality were really important to figuring out what was true and what was false. What you see coming out of conservative media is instead this idea that things are true when they have ideological integrity, that they are true when they conform to the assumptions of the ideology. So if something fits in with conservative ideas, then it is true. And if it doesn't, then it is worth challenging. And so that's a big shift to measure the value of a news source based on how well it conforms to your ideas about the world. And that's something that really spreads within conservatism as the dependence on conservative media grows into the 80s and 90s and 20-aughts. So it has a small effect in the 1950s and 1960s, but in the 1950s and 60s, there just aren't that many conservative media outlets to consume. There's no way to really construct your entire media diet around conservative media. That changes by the time you get to the 1990s and the 20-aughts, at a point which you can only read media or only consume media that conform to your beliefs about the world and don't necessarily need to conform with feedback from reality. And that's something that we've seen affecting our politics in the last 5 or 10 years or so.
The other really important finding in your book related to how they cultivated image, this idea of being outsiders, as being oppressed, but it was really a group of elites who claimed populism. How does that work?
This I found really interesting because the populist language was there from the start with the American right, this idea that we were outsiders, that we were being excluded from power by big institutional forces and by special interests, but that really conservatives were the voice of the people that were being excluded. But again, as you just pointed out, these were elites. These were Ivy League graduates. These were well-heeled lawyers. These were folks who had been appointed to the highest levels of government. So they had access to traditional sources of economic, political, and social power. But the issue was they felt entitled to all sorts of power. They felt entitled to run a political party. They felt entitled to the presidency, and they felt entitled to control of the culture. And when they didn't have those things, they thought that that exclusion must be because something in the system had been rigged, that there was some way that they were being excluded from what was rightfully theirs. And so you have this combination of entitlement and exclusion that feed this very powerful form of populism that would continue to be part of the conservative identity through up through today, that even in times like the 1980s and the 1990s, in the early 2000s, when conservatives control the presidency, the Congress, the Supreme Court, you still have that outsider identity. And that outsider identity is important because otherwise it's just elites ruling things as opposed to speaking for the people. And I think that's been one of the most powerful and effective things that conservatism has done in the United States in the 20th century is to claim to be the voice of the people at a time, especially in the early years, where it really was just a small group of elites.
Now, how do you fit the muckraking of the time and the yellow journalism of the time into this dynamic?
So you see in the early parts of the 20th century, journalism sort of developing on two different tracks. You have this idea of objectivity that I was talking about earlier, but you also have this idea of muckraking, that journalism shouldn't be neutral, that it should be emotional and impassioned, and it should be advocacy journalism. It should be fighting for something. So you see this when you see journalists going out and investigating meatpacking industry or investigating asylums, that not only are they investigating these things to find out what's happening, but in order to suggest certain policies. And in those early years of muckraking, those policies almost always involved more government involvement, that we needed more government oversight of consumer goods, more government oversight of institutions. Conservative media really does fit into that tradition of muckraking because it has both that emotional core, it has that advocacy side, and it has that driver of political change, right? The end goal is to change politics in the United States. So even though it doesn't have a shared lineage in terms of whether it falls on the right or left of American politics, it does have that shared sort of sense of what journalism is for.
How did the media link with other actors to make it a movement?
So this is the most interesting thing for me is when I first started this project, I didn't necessarily think of media as a form of activism. Or if it were a form of activism, it was just a form of activism in spreading ideas. But what I found in the conservatives that I studied was that their media activism, their media presence, marked them as leaders for conservatives who didn't really have any sort of organization to join, who had a lot of confusion about politics and the two parties that didn't seem to represent them. And so what you see happening is that their audiences, their listeners and their readers were getting in touch with people like Clarence Mannion and like Bill Rusher and saying, look, you've got us stirred up with all of these ideas, but what are we supposed to do? And they turned to these media voices in order to actually do something, to found organizations, to get them involved in electoral politics. And so you see someone like Clarence Mannion going off and pushing for the nomination of Barry Goldwater in 1960. So he organizes Americans for Goldwater in order to try to win Barry Goldwater, who's very conservative, to win him the nomination in 1960. And in order to do that, he falls back on his ideas about media as the path to political change. He has Goldwater write a book of conservative belief called The Conscience of a Conservative, which really transforms Goldwater as a senator into the face of conservatism in the United States. And while Goldwater doesn't win the nomination in 1960, he wins it in 1964. So you have that political activism. You also have someone like Bill Buckley, who, again, is the founder of National Review, going off and founding the organization Young Americans for Freedom in order for there to be an organization for college students and young people to join in order to learn about conservative politics and become political activists. And that central role that these media folk play actually turn them into leaders of a movement rather than simply just messengers, rather than simply just voices on the radio or writers in magazines.
Now, how do groups like the Birch Society, the John Birch Society, and those types of organizations fit in with this?
So the John Birch Society was founded in 1958, and it was this very anti-communist group that was super secretive. The idea was that it was a secret society that was going to help weed out communism in the United States. They assumed that about 60% of the United States had already been taken over by communists in order to help America win the Cold War. The Birch Society went largely overlooked for the first few years, but in 1961, journalists sort of discover the Birch Society, and it both amuses and concerns them. It amuses them because they find a conspiratorial core, this idea that you shouldn't put fluoride in the water or that there are communists hiding under every bed. But on the other hand, it is this secret society that they worry could be a source of real radicalism and unrest in the United States, that they could be opening a widening war within the U.S. because they perceive everyone up to Dwight Eisenhower, the president, as a communist. And so there's this concern that the John Birch Society represents a radical right that could spread violence and unrest in the United States. The reason that that matters is that even though the Birch Society was a small organization, probably 50 to 100,000 people, it was used to kind of tar the rest of the conservative movement as crackpot conspiracists rather than actual mainstream political activists.
Now, some of the pieces that they published, such as The Merchants of Death, would probably appeal not just to highly conservative people, because this exposed some aspects of the military-industrial complex.
It's interesting how much, especially in the 1930s and 40s, the early conservative movement would have appealed to folks on the left just as much as on the right, because they are taking on the major institutions of the day. There's a strong pacifist story in the origins of conservative media. If we're talking about sort of start dates for modern conservative media, it really comes out of the America First movement. And the America First movement, which was the movement to oppose U.S. entry into World War II, it's often been caricatured as isolationist or having ties to the far right, being perhaps fascistic. But it actually drew from a wide range of people, including socialists on the left and progressives like Robert La Follette, and then from right-wingers as well. It shows how politics could cut across left-right divisions.
I wonder, when the fairness doctrine came in, if it had some effect to move this type of media back out to the margins, and then when it came back, it allowed them back in. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, so the Fairness Doctrine, which is a regulation on radio that requires both controversial issues to be covered and to be covered fairly, my sense of the way that the effect that it had in the period between like the late 1950s until it was repealed in 1987 was that it had a chilling effect on voices on the margins. And that actually included conservatives. So conservatives were seen as controversial because they wanted things like a more militaristic approach to the Cold War. They wanted to repeal Social Security, these ideas that just weren't in the mainstream of either party. But it also had a chilling effect on the left as well, on socialists, on some labor union broadcasts. So it had this way of defining the legitimate parameters of debate, and then kind of chilling the folks on the fringes of that. It gets repealed in 1987, right before Rush Limbaugh goes national in 1988. So there is a connection between removing the Fairness Doctrine and the creation of a more powerful national conservative media on radio. That said, it wasn't just the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. There were a number of technological things that had to change. There were a number of political things that had to change in order to get audiences of the size that Rush Limbaugh got.
So now that you've done this sort of deep history, what can you draw from that that helps inform what's going on in American politics right now today?
I think that there are two big things coming out of this that help us understand better the current politics of today. One of them is the polarization in American society isn't just a political polarization, but it is an ideas and sort of sources polarization. That there has been over the past 10 to 15 years the development of a conservative media ecosystem that is entirely contained. So it now is possible for part of the American public to have its own facts and to operate from those. And that actually has a political effect. It eliminates any sort of common ground, common language, common understanding in order to have a politics built on shared values, shared ideas, even just shared facts. And we see that in the breakdown of the American political system, the obstructionism, the unprecedented nature of the 2016 campaign. So I think that that is a big part of it as well. The other major thing is we have Donald Trump being advised by a conservative media figure, Steve Bannon of Breitbart News. And as someone who has studied conservative media, it seems to me that we're entering a new period in conservative media where we're actually moving away from strictly conservative media to more right-wing media. So Breitbart is a site that doesn't define as conservative. It defines as populist nationalist. And just as Trump has disrupted the conservative hold on the Republican Party, so Breitbart has disrupted the conservative hold on right-wing media. It is now more populist. It is more fragmented. And I think that those changes in media and changes in politics are closely related. It's not a coincidence that conservative media and the conservative hold in the Republican Party are breaking apart at the same time.
I imagine because of the financial element that side tends to have a lot more money. And with the internet, there's also a lot more power behind these groups.
I think that's right. Although what's interesting about it is that, you know, the most profitable parts of conservative media are Fox News, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity on radio, these more formal institutions that have been around a lot longer. And those have actually become the conservative media establishment that folks like Breitbart are taking on. And these websites have a ton of money. I think that's beginning to change. But they've been able to have a major effect without as much funding because the internet allows them to do their media activism without much of a buy-in cost. It costs a lot of money to start a television network. It costs a lot of money to build a national radio program. It doesn't cost very much to host a website, and you know, their costs grow over time, but it's just not nearly as expensive. And so more people can get in and more ideas can be sort of fostered in those environments. And I think that's part of this fragmentation story.
Well, Nicole Hemmer, author of Messengers of the Right, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nicole Hemmer is Assistant Professor of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics.
When we come back,
25 years after the LA civil unrest, what has changed?
Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, 25 years after the LA civil unrest, what has changed? Manuel Pastor is professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity and director of the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity, as well as the Center for Immigrant Integration at USC. His books include Up Against the Sprawl, Regions That Work, This Could Be the Start of Something Big, in his latest, Equity, Growth, and Community, What the Nation Can Learn from America's Metro Areas. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Manuel Pastor. It's great to have you with us again.
It's good to be with you.
Well, let's begin with the historic context of the civil unrest in Los Angeles. It was 25 years ago. What would you say we need to understand about this context?
I think we need to understand both the continuity and the change, the sort of turning point that South LA is at right now. When we think about the unrest 25 years ago, it was rooted in a bunch of different phenomena. One, of course, was police brutality, and in particular the beating of Rodney King, and the fact that the four police officers who had done it were let off scot-free by a jury in Simi Valley. That certainly triggered rage. There were also bubbling racial tensions generally within Los Angeles. A couple of weeks after Rodney King had been beaten, a young African-American woman, Latasha Harlins, was shot in a market by a Korean shop owner who claimed that she was shoplifting. The video suggests that she was not, and that shop owner got off, she was convicted of manslaughter, but got off with very modest fine and some hours of community service. So there were sort of bubbling racial tensions there and very tough economic circumstances. In the early 1990s, about one quarter of the nation's job losses had occurred in Los Angeles. And those significant economic distresses led to what was the pattern of the unrest. There was first a sort of political riot in downtown Los Angeles with people protesting against the police. There was a sort of second riot at the corner of Florence and Normandy with young African-American men pulling non-black motorists out of their car and beating them. That's where the famous white trucker Reginald Denny got pulled out of his truck and beaten to within, you know, minutes of losing his life. Important footnote, he was actually rescued by four local black residents who put him back in the truck and drove that truck to a hospital for him to get the needed care. But once that happened, and it became apparent that the police were no longer around for law and order, essentially what we saw was the third and most important wave of the unrest, a bread riot. And that bread riot was people looting, arson, and that occurred in many different neighborhoods, in neighborhoods that tended to be twice as poor as the rest of Los Angeles, half the home ownership rates, be experiencing the most distress. So the LA riots were a sort of perfect stew of challenges with regard to policing, shifts in terms of racial relations, and this kind of underlying economic distress.
And so if we were to now fast forward over those 25 years, a lot has been happening, particularly in the community of South Los Angeles. And you noted some of this in one of your opinion pieces that was on KCET, I believe. And you said this is partly because of several of the community organizations. Can you elaborate on what some of these have been doing over 25 years? Scope, community coalition, what have they been doing?
Well, I mean, I think the important thing to realize is that a lot of these organizations, some of them existed before the civil unrest. Community Coalition had already been actively organizing around substance abuse and around shutting down nuisance liquor stores. Scope actually came out of the civil unrest. A number of other organizations in Los Angeles were given new legs. And part of that was when, you know, people realized that if you have a city that's pissed off enough around police brutality and economic desperation to burn itself down, and you haven't been able to channel that into something more positive, there's probably something wrong with your organizing. So part of what's happened where the terrain is really different is, number one, the police department has seen significant reform. There's still excessive force, there's still challenges, and people are right to be protesting against the LAPD. But it's a very different police department, much more connected to community policing than it was before. That's been the result of a lot of community pressure and some legal pressure as well. There's also been real shifts in terms of relationships between organizations, between ethnic groups. One of the things that became very clear during the LA civil unrest is that while people thought South LA was the heart of black Los Angeles, and it was, they thought that that meant it was almost entirely black. By the time of the LA civil unrest, South Los Angeles was about 47-48% Latino. Today it's about two-thirds Latino. That big demographic change of the growth of Latinos, actually the decline in the black population in South Los Angeles, had a lot to do with tensions between groups. But a lot of groups like Community Coalition, Scope, there's another group named Cadre that does a lot of work with parents, have really focused in on black-brown unity, building ties between communities, doing real grassroots organizing that brings people together. The third big phenomenon is that many of these groups have developed a pretty clear economic analysis. They've realized that the problems of the unrest were not just driven by the police, not just driven by racial changes. They were also driven, of course, by the economic desperation that South LA faced. And so you've seen Scope organize for green jobs and job training. You've seen Community Coalition organize for better education, including getting in college prep courses so kids can go on to succeed. You've seen groups like CD Tech, which is in the eastern part of South Los Angeles, think hard about community development and fight hard against a new phenomenon of gentrification. So these community organizations have created a very strong social fabric. The challenge is that not a lot has really changed in terms of the economic data. Unemployment is still high. Poverty rates are still much higher than they are in the rest of the county, although there are some new things.
So you noted the effort to bring in green jobs. Was there some success that we should note there?
Some of the success, which has been kind of interesting, has been movement away from the idea that it's simply about bringing good jobs to the neighborhood, but that it's also about bringing the neighborhood to good jobs. So Scope has fought for retrofitting of municipal buildings, of the city-owned buildings, to meet new green standards, but then they've also fought along with other organizations for apprenticeship programs aimed at African Americans and Latinos to bring them into the trade for that retrofitting. So that they've also, Scope in particular, has fought to try to get jobs in the entertainment industry, all of those sort of back-end jobs that are part of Hollywood, but you don't often think about, but they're good union jobs, to have those more open to people from South Los Angeles. There's also been groups like the Black Worker Center, which has struggled hard to try to make sure that new construction, particularly of rail lines in and through South LA, do have local hiring. And then there's also been a big union effort to organize security guards. Security guards are disproportionately African American in Southern California, many of them living in South Los Angeles. Again, there's been a real, you know, the old thought was you had to bring jobs to the neighborhood. The new thought is you need to both connect the neighbors to wherever the jobs are through chance at job training, local hiring requirements, and you need to bring jobs to the neighborhood through taking advantage of the investments in things like rail.
In that same article, you also noted that there were some failures that are important to note. One of them was Rebuild LA. What was the flaw there?
Well, to give the listeners a bit of a sense, Rebuild LA was launched on the Friday, 2 days after the verdict, and while embers were still smoking in Los Angeles, by Mayor Tom Bradley. He asked Orange County businessman Peter Uberoth to lead an effort that was to be named Rebuild LA, and it was to try to bring corporate investment to South Los Angeles. It was a pretty misguided effort in many different ways. After all, this was an area that had been abandoned by corporations, the industrial corridor had abandoned in terms of shopping centers. So the idea that that was going to be what rescued South Los Angeles after it was what had abandoned South Los Angeles seemed pretty misplaced. The other sort of fatal flaw was that by selecting a white businessman to head the thing from Orange County, there were a lot of challenges around, is he really a person of the community, which of course he wasn't. As a result, he wound up putting together a very big advisory committee of 50 people, which was pretty much a recipe for not getting very much done. It's hard to do much when you've got that many people. So Rebuild LA really failed to attract corporate investment, failed to get the lots rebuilt, etc. It eventually morphed into something called RLA, which moved under the name Linda Gallego to a little bit more around small business development. That morphed into something that's called CD Tech. And CD Tech today actually runs a lot of organizing of local residents around economic development issues. So they run a youth program called Public Allies that brings a lot of local young people to learn to be advocates for the community. They're training people in local community development, and they've been very instrumental in what is now a very central fight in South Los Angeles, the fight against gentrification.
And then there was something you mentioned on the positive front around a promise zone and how the community organized to do this. It was quite a feat. What happened there?
It's a very intriguing story. The federal government, about 5 years ago, launched promise zones. And what promise zones were parts of cities that were going to be designated for special treatment, priority treatment, when they applied for federal grants. In the first year, Los Angeles got one, but it was mostly in mid-city and in East Hollywood. Pretty poor area, heavily immigrant, but there's a lot of development going on there as well because it picks up parts of Koreatown, which are really sort of thriving at this point in terms of investment. So there was a lot of resentment from South Los Angeles that they hadn't been considered or nominated by the city. Part of the reason had to do with some of the requirements of the program. So South Los Angeles lobbied the city, and then the city lobbied the federal government to change the regulations so South LA could apply. South LA applied 2 years ago and got rejected. And when they asked why the South LA Province Zone application had been rejected, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, said that it was because there wasn't enough housing problems in South LA and not enough economic problems. Anyone who spent any time in South LA found that baffling. But the reason was that the way that HUD defined housing problems was as vacancy, which is something that's typical of a place like Detroit or Cleveland, lots of abandoned houses. The problem in South LA is overcrowding, particularly of immigrant households. The way that HUD defined economic distress was purely through unemployment. In South Los Angeles, there's significant unemployment for African Americans, but for Latinos, particularly immigrants, and 17% of South LA is undocumented. Those folks, they don't get unemployment insurance. They are really, their problem is one of working poverty, that is having a job, but with very low wages. So rather than accept the result of what HUD had decided, these 30 community organizations working together got the Secretary of HUD to visit South LA, made a case that the criteria were wrong. We were a part of that by helping to marshal some of the sort of empirical data to prove that South LA faced significant housing and economic distress, just of a type that wasn't typical of the East Coast. HUD changed its rules, and this last year when South LA applied, I believe there were over 140 applications, and South LA's application was number two in the country. Now, that's important for a number of different reasons, to do federal resources, et cetera. But what it speaks to is a particular growing confidence on the part of the community groups, not taking no for an answer, fighting when the rules at first excluded them, fighting when the second set of rules excluded them, being insistent that they needed to be prioritized, and working together. And actually, even the plan itself, which is built around rail lines, which is really the only way in South LA you can bring African Americans and Latino communities together, because the rail lines run through both of those communities. It really speaks to the sheer new level of confidence, tactical brilliance, and strategic thinking of South LA organizations.
Now, the last time that you joined us on this program, it was a long time ago, was when your book came out, This Could Be the Start of Something Big. How do you see the sort of changes that you're describing now in South LA in that context of the work that you did in that book?
You know, I feel about that book that it was prescient. We were talking about movement organizations that were increasingly learning to look at the metropolitan economy, that were increasingly learning to build bridges between ethnic communities and geographic communities, that were tackling issues of social justice, but making an economic argument along the way, and doing that with both great confidence and great forethought about where the economy was headed. We actually got criticized by some folks saying, you don't have that much evidence. I feel like since the book, the evidence has developed, particularly in Los Angeles. We have an extraordinary set of community organizations that think regionally, think productively about the economy, are looking forward to tackle big problems. It's not just the ones I've mentioned, but the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, the Labor Community Strategy Center. I could sort of go down the line on a number of groups that are really kind of forward-looking. Now, one of the ways that I think they're especially forward-looking now is, you know, rather than asking what happened with deindustrialization that's important, or what happened with the changing economy. So trying to take a look at what the next issue is. And the next big issue in Los Angeles, it's ongoing actually, is gentrification. That is, how can we do development without displacement? This is a particular challenge for South Los Angeles, because if you look at the rest of LA, a place that was once low income or had low income pockets like Venice has become overrun with million-dollar houses. Places like Echo Park and Silver Lake have been gentrified. East LA is experiencing some of this. Highland Park, which is where I used to live and used to be very, very immigrant and, you know, pretty low income, is now the new hotspot in Los Angeles. And the next hotspot is South LA, because South LA has tremendously, you know, attractive single-family housing stock. It's always had disinvested commercial and transit corridors, but now that the rail lines are coming into South LA, and following that, public investment is now some new private investment. There was the announcement of a new Honda dealership much further in South Los Angeles than we've ever seen a dealership come. And you're going to see new businesses and new housing right around there. Now there's a lot of thought that a lot of the longtime residents face a lot of threats to being able to hang on to their house or being able to keep rents at an affordable level. That's the next big challenge for groups in South LA.
Now, do you see this same type of development and pattern in the other cities that you had included in that book? I think you had Detroit, Chicago, the Bay Area, Milwaukee. Have they experienced similar changes, both good and bad?
Well, I think we've seen some great organizing in the Bay Area, again, across a very sort of tough challenge of the way in which housing prices have skyrocketed there. I think you see some very interesting efforts, certainly in Detroit now. Seattle is a metropolitan region that was one of the first big metro region to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour. That's been an interesting set of organizing and thinking regionally and figuring out how to look forward. I think you see some of this happening in unexpected places as well. There's been interesting work being done in Charlotte, North Carolina, which after all is the place that, sort of triggered the political backlash by first passing protections for transgender and LGBTQIA folks. What's very interesting is that we have really emerged with a complete disjuncture between what's happening on the national political scene and these very interesting glimmers of hope in many of our metropolitan areas. So we've got this extraordinarily right-wing regime in Washington taking the country in a very backward direction, even as some of the most dynamic metropolitan regions in the country are welcoming immigrants, trying to figure out what they need to do to reform their police department, trying to think about incorporating equity into their economic development strategies. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I think there's this extraordinary disjuncture between what's happening in some of our metro regions and certainly what's happening nationwide. And you see it in some big states too, like Texas, where you've had progressive mayors in Houston and in San Antonio and in Austin against a sea of red that is trying to keep Texas tough and unfriendly.
I wonder if one is affecting the other in the opposite direction too, meaning we saw a little bit of a backlash already against the cities who declared themselves sanctuary cities, etc. So during this Trump era, I wonder if there will be an effort to sort of quash what these groups have managed to do so far. What do you see in the future on that?
Oh, I think we're all facing tough times. You and I are speaking on the day that the Republican House of Representatives decided to basically tear apart the Affordable Care Act, something that is going to touch and endanger so many people. Very cruel move. And I think we're going to see a lot of almost last gasps. But the thing that's very striking, you know, is that if you look at the dynamic economies in the country, they are places where there's more diversity. There's places where there's more immigrants. There's places where they're at least trying in some different ways to step up to the challenge of creating more equitable development. And the places that went for Trump, I mean, with some exceptions, there are places where there's a lot of fear of demographic change, even though a lot of it's happened in a place like Ohio. There's a lot of fear of economic dislocation. That part's real. But these are areas of the U.S. that seem to be really mired in a permanent kind of economic distress. There's going to be a kind of big battle between conservative and progressive forces, but there's also going to be a sort of big battle between the dynamic and dying sectors of the economy. As much as you and I and many people listening here might value climate change, for example, and we think we're fighting against certainly oil companies and people with a reactionary point of view about that, you also have some of the leading venture capitalists in California eager to develop green tech and clean energy and get ahead of the curve so that they can market internationally. And they're not opposed to what California is trying to do in terms of more restrictions to make the production processes cleaner, because they know that that's going to develop a market for them. And they see the coal mining industry as dying. So there's a kind of tug in the country right now between, you know, the emerging people of color and a sort of anxious white population. Bridges to be built there, but a lot of anxiety. There's a tug of war between progressive and conservative forces. And there's a tug of war between dynamic and dying sectors of the economy.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if you could see it as sort of the people who are uncomfortable with change really just reacting to changes that are, in many cases, like you mentioned, the green developments, they're necessary.
I do think it's a fear of change. And I think that part of the thing that Trump got totally right, and it's something that I think a lot of people miss, if you listen during the election, he said a lot of racist things, and that got him folks who were going to vote on that basis. But when he talked about the economy, he always talked about jobs. Didn't talk about the economy. Didn't talk about income. Talked about jobs. Because jobs provide income, but they also provide meaning. You know, it means a lot when you have a place to go every day and when you have a degree of pride in the craft that you're part of and the work that you do. I think sometimes people who are intellectuals, professionals, sort of think that people who are working class don't have the same passion around their job that perhaps professionals do, but they do. I mean, I grew up working class, grew up in particular around the construction industry, and you know, people just have tremendous pride in the work that they do. And part of what's gone on in the United States is that as work has been disappearing, it disappeared a long time ago for a lot of African Americans in urban areas, but it's now disappearing for a lot of whites in rural and suburban areas. That's created a crisis of meaning. And that concern about who are you in the world, demographically, in terms of a job, has fed into this opiates crisis that we're seeing in the United States as well. So I think one thing we really need to be paying attention to is, yes, people are fearful of change, and we can kind of be curious about that or point fingers at it, but it's a real loss of meaning that's going on. And how do we figure out how to develop some empathy and pull some of the folks in a more progressive direction, and then understand that some folks you're not going to pull at all, and that's just the way politics roll.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about something that's slightly unrelated, but still related in many ways, and that is that you've been involved with what they're calling the faculty resistance. What exactly is happening there?
So I'm at USC, and USC faculty responded quickly after the election of Donald Trump with a letter that got signed by, I think, about 6,000 people, a lot of faculty, and then students and alums, to try to get the university to declare itself to be a sanctuary university. The university has not made that declaration, although some of the practices that it has pursued do provide some degree of protection, but not as much as we would like. So we've kept up the pressure with both lots of meetings with the administration, and then also we took out a full-page ad in the Los Angeles Times to call attention to the fact that there were a group of faculty standing in solidarity with our students and saying that we would stand in solidarity with them and others who engaged in civil disobedience and resistance. We are very concerned that there be no cooperation with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We are very concerned that the students who are fearful because they think that their DACA status might be revoked, that they get some legal assistance. The university has responded with a big investment in a legal clinic that's been made available to students, to faculty, and to staff. One last thing I'll say about this, one thing I'm very, very proud of about everything we've done. I think we're the only faculty group I've seen in the country, but I would very much urge other faculty groups, university groups to do this, to constantly come back to assistance that's needed for the staff. USC is the largest private employer in the city of Los Angeles. Probably all of our employees are, if they're non-citizen immigrants, lawful permanent residents because they've had E-Verify for quite a while. There may be some undocumented staff on board. But there are so many mixed status families, and they're very, very anxious about what's going on. So we've continued to insist and lift up that the university ought to launch naturalization classes and help with the fees for line staff, because if they're naturalized, they're going to be able to better defend those folks, either who have a green card and that can be uncertain, or who are undocumented and are part of their household. I would urge other people, when they think about university struggles, they tend to focus in on the students, but universities are generally very big employers, and those staff often get disappeared. They're not part of the public imagination. They're the reason why these offices are clean every day. They're the reason why our students are safe and well-fed. We need to make this a welcoming atmosphere for them and their families as well.
Manuel Pastor, thank you so much for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Manuel Pastor is professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity and director of the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity, as well as the Center for Immigrant Integration at USC. His books include This Could Be the Start of Something Big, and his latest, Equity, Growth, and Community, What the Nation Can Learn from America's Metro Areas. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.